Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul, editor of the Book Review. This week, we are talking about the May 5th issue of the review. First up will be Claire Massoud, author of the new novel, The Woman Upstairs.
That was a self-conscious choice that I wanted to fill a gap and write an angry woman. And I think nothing is more unseemly in society than an angry woman.
We also have Julie Bosman talking about what's going on out there in the publishing world this week. Ramona Ausubel, author of the new story collection, A Guide to Being Born, which is reviewed this week by the novelist Helen Oyeyemi.
I organize the stories into all together. It's one sort of birth cycle. So birth, gestation, conception, and finally love.
And also we will have Greg Coles, an editor at The Review, talking about bestsellers.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
I am here with Claire Massoud, the author of The Woman Upstairs, which is reviewed by Liesl Schillinger in this week's book review. Liesl calls the book a ingenious, disquieting novel and describes its language as urgent, its conflicts outsize and unmooring, its mood incendiary, and says this psychologically charged story feels like a liberation. How does that sound to you? Does that sound right?
Well, I'm grateful to her. For me as a writer, the book did feel a bit like a liberation in that I felt that it was time to embrace urgency without worrying about how it might be received. I was inhabiting a character that I was aware might not seem lovable to people.
There was a big kerfuffle online and in the print world and in the books world this week after an interview that you did with Publishers Weekly, in which the interviewer asked you a question that I won't ask you. But can you tell us a little bit about what that person did ask and your response? And
her comment was that she wouldn't want to be friends with Nora. So her question was, I wouldn't want to be friends with Nora. Would you?
And Nora is the protagonist.
Nora is
the
protagonist of the novel. Nora Eldridge is her name, and she's a school teacher, elementary school teacher, third grade, who makes art at home on the side. And the novel spans the time from age 37 to 42. And this interviewer said, "Oh, she wouldn't want to be friends with Nora." And then she said, "Her outlook on life is almost unbearably grim." So my response to that was to cite a whole roster of characters from literature that I love but would not want to be friends with, from Humbert Humbert to Oedipus to Hamlet to Oscar Wilde to the characters in Thomas Pynchon or Martin Amis and so on. And I couldn't help but feel that it was a gendered question. I don't think that as readers we expect to identify with or admire male protagonists. And I suddenly had the feeling that there was this expectation of a woman protagonist by a woman reader, and that was unsettling to me.
And it's interesting because the books that you bring up, the authors are all male of those books where there are these unlikable. Do you think women don't write these characters? Or
there were many strands that came into the making of this book, but one of them was the fact that as a reader, I've always loved ranting narrators from Dostoevsky on down the line, include, you know, people like Mickey Sabbath in Sabbath's Theater or Thomas Bernhardt's narrators in his novels. And there is a whole lineage of these angry, misfit, weirdo people, and they're all men written by men. And so that was a self-conscious choice that I wanted to fill a gap and write an angry woman. And I think nothing is more unseemly in society than an angry woman.
So let's talk about Nora Eldridge. She's a 37-year-old school teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What is she angry about? What's causing her anger?
In the context of the book, her anger specifically arises out of what she feels is the loss of close friendship that she develops with a family, a woman named Serena, who's an artist, and her husband, who's an intellectual, an academic, and their son, who's a pupil in her class. And she becomes very good friends with them over the course of a year, and indeed, one might say, obsessed with them. And when she feels that she has lost that friendship, she is furious. But the nature of the friendship, or the nature of her obsession, is actually that she sees in them the possibility, each separately, the possibility of fulfillment in her life in areas that she has had to give up or had felt she had to give up. So when she befriends them, she sees possibility. And her anger is really about the loss of that possibility.
So in Serena, who's a successful artist, and Nora creates these dioramas, right, sort of on the side, I'm assuming that she sees frustration in terms of what she could have been professionally and sort of creatively.
Nora started out wanting to be an artist. Just various circumstances, including the prolonged illness and death of her mother, for whom she served as a nurse, have kept her from fulfilling those dreams. It's not so much even that she wants to be Serena, is that when she sees Serena, she thinks, and when she becomes friends with Serena, she thinks, well, if it's possible for her, maybe it's possible for me too.
And what about the possibilities in the other two characters? What does she see in the son?
Early on in the book, she says, if you'd asked me where I wanted to be at the age of 40, I would have said I wanted to be an artist with children. And as an elementary school teacher who makes art in her apartment, she says, you know, I don't not have children, and I don't not make art, but they aren't my children. They go home at the end of the day. And she forms a very strong attachment to this little boy, who in some ways she thinks of almost as her own child. So that's what she sees in him, is the child she did not have.
And in the father?
And in the father, he's in some schematic, there are lots of things. She's attracted to him, but also she sees in him, he's very worldly. He's a Lebanese historian who studies the history of ethics, and he's also worldly. He sort of appears on television, you know, talking about the state of things in the Middle East and so on. And she suddenly feels that her world, her small world in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is open to the discovery of all the places and politics and everything that she had not thought were hers to notice or hers to be involved in.
And now you live in this small world of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you set your novel in it at roughly the same time period, right? What was that like? And having this novel take place in your backyard, so to speak.
Well, at least you feel you know whereof you speak, which is something, rather than setting it in the 17th century in Iran.
Right.
You know, some of the elements of the novel arose, I think, in some way out of the place, because Cambridge is on the one hand a very small town, and on the other it's unusual because of all the universities in the area, because it's very cosmopolitan. A lot of people come and go from all over the world, and people from all walks of life, and so it is both a small town and a big city, if you will.
And this novel, this is your first novel since The Emperor's Children, which came out in 2006. Have you been writing this, working on this novel during this whole period? How did the
arise? Gestation,
yes,
of it? One of the elements for Nora has been the illness of her and death of her mother. My 40s have been about family things. So both my parents fell ill and eventually died. So there was a lot of time in this past while that was not at all about writing. I have children. I was taking care of my children and my parents, and so
that terrible sandwich generation, right, situation.
So I did actually start another book. I had started another book, and it involved the death of a difficult patriarch. But every time I was working on it, my father would seem to get sick. So I felt as though I had some black magic effect, and so I put it to one side. And I started this book in about 2009, I think. And at the time, I was writing about a mother dying because my mother wasn't dying. But then again, in a sort of black magic way, my mother started to die. So,
oh, God. That has a way of happening, doesn't it? How did those two experiences then inform each other? We're writing about this and what Nora was going through or had been through, and then your own experience.
This book is very much a book about midlife, which hits different people in different ways and also at different times. You know, sometimes people don't have to confront the death of parents until they're 70. But in some cases, in Nora's case, she's much younger when her mother first falls ill. She's in her early 30s, and it's her 30s that are taken up with this as a carer. So it's not a book I would have or could have written 10 years earlier. I think there were apprehensions or insights that I only became aware of in this recent time of my life.
And then it's sort of the emperor's children. You know, it's you're moving a decade later with each book, right? That was about the characters were in their late 20s.
They were turning 30. They were also turning 30.
30, yeah. And now we're turning in the 40. 40s. So your next one will be about someone in their 50s.
Well, I hope I can be a little faster than that. Maybe I can try to get somebody 45 in there. I don't know. Maybe I'll write about a 5-year-old. I don't know.
Well, thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you. We'll look forward to the next one.
That was Claire Masood, author of The Woman Upstairs, which is reviewed in this week's issue of The Book Review by Liesl Schillinger. Masood is the author also of The Emperor's Children, which was a New York Times best book of the year, and two other novels, When the World Was Steady and The Last Life.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character by Paul Tough. That's How Children Succeed, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
This is John Williams, an editor at The Times. I'm here with Julie Bosman, who has notes from the field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, John.
So we're reaching that point yet again where there's going to be a whole slew of political books in the lead up to the 2016 presidential election. One of them is, or was supposed to be, a biography of Andrew Cuomo by Fred Dicker. What's the latest with that?
So HarperCollins has found itself in a little bit of political drama this week. Last year, it had signed up a biography of Andrew Cuomo by Fred Dicker, who's the dean of the Albany Press Corps and a columnist for the New York Post. This was announced last year as an authorized biography of the governor, but it was supposed to be scheduled for this year, and somehow it never appeared on HarperCollins' publication schedule. So this week, HarperCollins said that it would publish instead a biography by Andrew Cuomo, a memoir of his own. And a source of ours said that HarperCollins did not want to publish both books because it would have a conflict of interest.
So where does this leave Dicker?
So this leaves Dicker in an interesting position. First of all, there's sort of the awkwardness of the fact that HarperCollins is owned by News Corp, as is the New York Post. HarperCollins said on the record that they do have a book that is still under contract with Fred Dicker, but they did not say when they were going to publish it or if they would publish it at all. So they're in a bit of limbo with this biography.
And is Cuomo's memoir going to cover his entire life or be a sort of a full biography?
Yes, they said that it would be a full and frank look at his public and private life. So this is a book that's obviously a preparation for a possible run for president. It's a book that will introduce Governor Cuomo to a wider audience beyond New York. And that book is scheduled for publication in 2014, which is the year that he's expected to be running for re-election to a second term as governor.
And do we know what happened with the Dicker book? I mean, obviously it's in a purgatory now. No one really is saying officially what its status is, but it seems like if they've signed up a Cuomo memoir, then this book is probably its fate is not great. Did Dicker and Cuomo, they were working together and Cuomo was cooperating. Was there a fallout there that was the reason? The book is now in that purgatory?
It seems like there was the relationship between Mr. Cuomo and Mr. Dicker seems to have soured in the last year. And while it's unclear what exactly happened, Mr. Dicker has been very critical of the governor recently. They used to have a very close relationship. The governor would come on his radio show. He was really a regular. Mr. Dicker had a lot of scoops about the administration. But lately, Mr. Dicker has been very critical of Mr. Cuomo, especially over matters of gun control. And Mr. Cuomo hasn't gone on Mr. Dicker's radio show in several months.
So we know that we're getting a memoir from Cuomo, and Mr. Dicker's book, we'll have to wait and see.
Yes, we'll wait and see. And what would be really interesting is if another publisher would somehow pick up the book, if HarperCollins wanted to release Mr. Dicker from his contract, right, maybe allowing him to hold on to the chunk of advance that he's had already. You know, it becomes a much more interesting book in some ways.
Unauthorized,
without Mr. Cuomo's cooperation. And Mr. Dicker is known as someone who doesn't mince any words. So I would certainly love to read a book by him that doesn't have the cooperation of the governor.
Great. Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, John.
I am on the phone with Ramona Ossabel. She is the author of a new story collection, A Guide to Being Born, which is reviewed in this week's issue of the Book Review by Helen Oyeyemi. Ossabel is calling in from Santa Barbara, from somewhere called Lotus Land. What is that?
It's a huge old estate. It's a woman who was a fanatic gardener, and it's gigantic with cactuses that are 40 feet high, and it's quite an incredible place.
Okay, well, welcome, and thank you for joining us. In the review this week, Oyeyemi says of the story collection, each story finds a way to record the tensions between the corporal and the invisible, the forces that animate us but ultimately can't be dissected, our anti-anatomies. The dismay of coming to the final page is easily combated by following the example of Ossabel's characters and beginning all over again. So that's a lovely introduction, and it speaks to, I think, the original way in which you organize these stories. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. When I was writing the stories, I was just writing one to the next, and then I had a group after a couple of years, and I was looking at them, and it became very clear that I was interested in certain themes at that point in my life, and the feeling of some of them are around actual birth, but others are around different kinds of transformation. So there are deaths, there are physical transformations. When a person falls in love, there's a physical transformation. One of the stories in which everybody grows another arm when they fall in love. I felt like I wanted to really push that question about transformation and birth and what that means and what the sort of cycle of that looks like. So I organized the stories into all together, it's one sort of birth cycle. So birth, gestation, conception, and finally love.
So we're going backwards in time.
We are, yes.
And why did you choose to do that?
Partly I think it just felt more interesting because it's a question immediately on opening the book. Oh, we're going backwards. Why are we going backwards? And I think it's always more interesting to start with a question than an answer.
And do you have an answer to the question?
Well, no, probably not. I think I end up feeling like maybe it's a loop, that we're all sort of in that loop all the time and things are constantly happening that push us into a new part of our lives. So we're maybe always somewhere in the cycle of being born over and over again.
And now, speaking of gestation and birth, this book originated to me in an interesting way in that the story Atria from it was published first in The New Yorker in 2011. But then your first novel came out last year. And I believe that you were working on both simultaneously. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I actually wrote the first draft, at least, of all of the stories before I had even begun the novel. So they kind of followed me along like old friends as I was working on the longer piece, and in fact were very helpful because I was writing a novel is a scary thing. So it was nice to have my old buddies, my little stories that I sort of knew and trusted and were already alive to keep coming back to as I was going.
And so why did the book come out, the novel come out before the stories?
I think that was mostly a publication decision. I think they felt like they could make a big splash with a new novelist, but I was happy either way.
So let's talk a little bit about these various stages. You had the first two stories in the collection, Safe Passage and Poppy Seed, fall into the birth section. Can you talk a little bit about those stories and about what you were trying to say about birth?
Sure. Safe Passage is about a group of grandmothers who find themselves on a freight boat at sea and have no idea why they're there or what it means. And pretty soon in the story, we flash back to one of the main character, Alice, in a hospital room, and we realize that perhaps she is dying. She realizes it at the same time. So that story is sort of about the question of what, none of us know what happens the next thing when we die, and I think it could easily be that we all end up on ships at sea, or we could, you know, any number of strange things could happen and no one knows. So that was about that kind of birth, of the birth into the greatest unknown of all. And then Poppy Seed is about a parents of a severely disabled daughter who is coming of age, and they have to figure out what to do physically to take care of her because she will become too big for them, and they worry about her becoming getting a period and growing breasts and how complicated that becomes with someone who won't go on as an adult the way that others will. So that was about a sort of birth, that the second birth of these parents, that they've had this child years before, but now they have to have her in a new way.
I'm talking to Ramona Asabel, calling in via phone from Santa Barbara, and we're talking about her new story collection, A Guide to Being Born, which is divided into these four sections. The first section is birth, which we were just discussing, and then you move on to gestation. Can you talk a little bit about those three stories? One of them, Atria, was published in The New Yorker 2 years ago.
Yeah, so Atria is about a girl who is in high school, and she gets pregnant. She's not sure who the father is. It's either a sort of meaningless one-off guy or a forced sexual situation. And she gets pregnant, and she's afraid, and it doesn't really make sense to her that this baby would be human. It doesn't feel like it was conceived in a human situation. So she begins to believe that first it's a sort of a ball of light growing inside of her, and then it turns into an eagle, and then pretty soon she imagines it as a three-headed giraffe. And at no point in the pregnancy does she really believe that it will be human. Chest of Drawers is about an expectant father who his wife is soon to deliver, and he wakes up in the morning and develops these drawers in his chest, and he wonders what has happened to him. And I think I was really thinking about in that story how strange it is to be the sort of observing party, that the woman is doing all of this. She's completely miraculous. All these amazing things are happening inside of her, and the father is just there. He's done his job already, at least physically.
I was going to say, apparently the fathers do gain weight very often alongside the mothers.
Yes, and I think they are. I mean, I'm sure that there are lots of physical things that are actually happening, that they're very tuned to their wives or partners' bodies and everything that's going on. But it's so different, and it's so strange. I think pregnancy is so strange. Anyway, that also will come through in this book. It's just a very magical and bizarre thing that happens to so many people all over the world, and it's something we think of as being completely normal. And, of course, it is normal, but it's also sort of unbelievable.
And I think from your description of Chest of Drawers, listeners are probably realizing that these stories are not entirely realistic, that there's a fantastical element to many of them.
Definitely, yes. Although I still feel like they're definitely fantastical. But I think that fantasticalness is really just a turning the volume all the way up on things that are real. So pregnancy being this sort of fantastical process. And what if we just, crank that sort of off the regular charts and see what would happen if it got bigger and bigger?
How do you think of this fantastical element as sort of as serving these stories and these ideas? Is it that it highlights the strangeness of what we consider to be normal?
Yeah, I think it does. It highlights the strangeness, and I guess it's sort of like putting something under a microscope, blowing it up really big so you can see it. It's a thing that's around you and that you've noticed before, perhaps, but that is too small to really get your head around. So this, I use it in this way to sort of make the thing so big that it sits down right in front of you and you can actually kind of study it and get a feel for it.
And are these stories sort of meant to be read as a kind of through narrative that you begin with the birth and you go through to love, or do you think of them as kind of standing alone, or are they sort of fundamentally interconnected?
I think both are true. I think they definitely stand on their own, but I also really, I liked the way the book started to come together when I put them in that sequence. And I think they all together kind of tell one story.
What is that story that is told through this collection, A Guide to Being Born?
I think it's the story of what happens to us when we are put in situations where love sort of mutates us and transforms us and turns us into new versions of ourselves all the time. So we are born in one way when we fall in love with someone, we're born another way when we become parents, we're born another way when people around us begin to die, and we're born again when we ourselves are facing the end of our lives.
Well, thank you so much. That was Ramona Ossabel, author of the new story collection, A Guide to Being Born, which is being reviewed in this week's issue of The Book Review by Helen Oyeyemi. Ramona, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pamela. It was a pleasure.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, John.
What's new on the list this week?
There is a whole lot new on the list this week.
I see a lot of yellow highlighter marks.
Yeah, almost half the list is new. Wow. On the fiction side of things, starting at number 15, Isabel Allende has a new novel out. It's called Maya's Notebook. Then at number 10 on the list this week, Amanda Quick, who is really Jane Ann Krentz. It's one of the seven different names that Krentz writes under, has a novel called The Mystery Woman. Then at number 6, Sophie Kinsella, a longtime regular on the list for her Shopaholic series, has a standalone rom-com novel called Wedding Night. At number 4, Edward Rutherford, who's kind of a modern-day James Michener. He writes these epic historical novels centered on places of interest.
Great cities.
He's got New York, a novel called New York, and a novel called London. This one is Paris, and it's the same thing that Rutherford does in his. Mm-hmm. It mixes real characters and fictional characters mm-hmm. to tell this kind of sweeping narrative of the city. Then at number 3, Kristen Hanna, who had a big bestseller on the paperback list back in 2009. Her book Firefly Lane spent 28 weeks on the paperback list, is back with a follow-up to that book called Fly Away. And finally, at number 1 this week, David Baldacci, another longtime regular, has a book called The Hit about a government assassin who is trying to track down a fellow assassin who's gone rogue, and in the process of trying to track him down, he uncovers a possible conspiracy. Then on the nonfiction side of things, again, a lot of new titles, starting down at the bottom of the list, number 16, Mitchell Zuckoff has a book called Frozen in Time. It is an interesting story. In 1942, a U.S. cargo plane crashed in Greenland, and the government sent a B-17 on a rescue mission to get the cargo plane. And that B-17 also crashed. But all 9 airmen aboard survived.
Wow.
And so then they sent another rescue mission, an amphibious plane, that vanished. Into a storm and disappeared. And so
then they stopped trying.
They did, but in 2012, Zuckoff joined an expedition with the Coast Guard and a private company trying to look for remains of the plane that vanished in the storm. Then at number 12 on the nonfiction list this week, a really sad story, a memoir called I'll See You Again by Jackie Hance with the co-writer Janice Kaplan. Jackie Hance, I don't know if you'll recognize the name. Do you remember back in 2009, this horrific crash on the Taconic Parkway?
Oh, God,
the woman driving her minivan the wrong way. She was driving on the northbound parkway, but she was driving south. And
I do
she
remember
collided.
That. That was terrible.
She died. The driver did. And
there was a lot of mystery surrounding sort of why she was doing what she was doing.
Yeah, the New York State investigators found that she had twice the blood alcohol limit and had been smoking marijuana. And she was clearly disoriented. She had called her brother at the time to report that she was disoriented and having trouble seeing. Witnesses had reported her throwing up at the side of the road. Her husband kept insisting, no, she wasn't a drinker. She, you know, she couldn't have been drunk. And he tried to defend her name for a long time. But after almost a year, the state said, no, we stand by our findings.
Right. I think that was the mystery that I was remembering. Not so much a mystery as much as contended facts. You know, the husband was sort of arguing against the narrative.
In that car, three of the passengers who died in the car that day were, the driver was Diane Schuler, and it was three of her nieces died, the daughters of the brother that she was calling to report that she was disoriented. Her brother was Warren Hantz, and his wife is Jackie Hantz. Mm-hmm. And Jackie now is telling what it was like to lose that. That was all three of their daughters. It ravaged the marriage. It, you know, it just put an incredible, unbearable strain on the family.
Sure.
But they have come through it. They've now had a fourth daughter.
And, oh, wow.
And so it's a story partly.
They stayed together.
Yes, they did stay together, and they are giving it another go.
Well, that's good. It's nice to have a glimmer of light in such a – that's a really dark story.
It really is. Then at number eight, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google and now their executive chairman of Google – has written a book with Jared Cohen called The New Digital Age, which is just looking at the promises and dangers of our interconnected world. He talks a bit about info warfare, cyber warfare as a danger. Then at number seven, a guy named Dave Liniger, or Liniger, has a book called My Next Step. He's a businessman. He started Remax Real Estate. Mm-hmm. And back in January 2012, he woke up in the middle of the night unable to move from the neck down. He was paralyzed. At first, he thought he was just having back problems, as he occasionally had had. It turns out he had a staph infection that threatened to paralyze him for good. He went into the hospital for something like 7 months. He was finally released in July of 2012. And this is his account of his journey back from that paralysis, his determination to walk again. And so it's called My First Step.
I have to say, Greg, that so far, the list this week is cataclysmic and terrifying. I know we're slowly moving towards something humorous, but keep going.
I don't know. At number five on the nonfiction list, Jeremy Scahill, who is the national security correspondent for The Nation, he previously wrote a book about the Blackwater kind of private defense firm, has a book along the same lines called Dirty Wars, and it's looking into the covert wars that we fund and who's really fighting them. Again,
he's a critic of them or just an investigative reporter?
I mean, he's an investigative reporter, but as an investigative reporter for The Nation, which has a more liberal slant as media goes, he is... I mean, he's an investigative reporter. He's reporting the truth, but he is looking at it, you know, from this kind of standpoint.
Yeah.
Then at number four, a book called Trident Canine Warriors by Mike Ritland with Gary Brozek. I can just imagine the pitch meeting for this book. It was...
Pitch it to me.
Dogs and Navy SEALs.
Done.
Guaranteed bestseller. Ritland, the author, is a former Navy SEAL himself, and when he was serving in Iraq, he saw the canine warriors that the Navy SEALs use, and he just realized, this is amazing. And after he retired from the SEALs, he started a private company that has become the biggest supplier of canine troops to America's elite forces.
That's great.
And so he kind of scours the world for them to find dogs that would have the right personalities to serve in these conditions. And then he trains them. And he talks about what they're looking for and what their training is. It's kind of a whole book about Navy SEALs as dogs.
Right. <It's> like, they give the dogs the Briggs-Myers test and they, you know, sort them by category. Now, okay, we've gone from Cataclysm to dogs. Everyone loves dogs, especially patriotic dogs, but I feel like we still got to get over the hump here a little bit.
You know who's going to take us over the hump is Michael Pollan.
We're not quite there yet. Nothing against Michael Pollan. He's a great writer. This is another serious book.
This book is not cataclysmic.
No, it's not. It's not.
New at number three, his book is called Cooked. He kind of merges food and politics. He looks at kind of big food, big industrial farming and things, and the impact that that has on the environment, on our health. And he's done that in his last few books, and now he's taking the next step and looking at home cooking and how we can improve our lives through home cooking. And he always takes kind of a personal slant in his, and so he's writing about his education as a home cook.
Right.
And then finally, new at number one this week, we are over the hump. This book is called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. It's written by David Sedaris, the longtime humorist. Got his start as an NPR commentator with This American Life. And
he's had several best-selling collections of humorous essays.
His books are a mainstay on the list. I write about him in the column this week. His essays are always a very embellished or exaggerated version of the truth, but they do always have some basis in his personal life. He writes about his family. He writes about his living circumstances.
Trips he's taken.
Exactly.
But does he get in trouble for this? I mean, a lot of, you know, there's so much in the last several years about nonfiction writers who, but because he writes with such levity, does he get more of a break?
Well, that's exactly it. He doesn't get in trouble. Back in 2007, which is the year after the James Frey scandal broke, when people found out that he had fabricated his drug memoir, this journalist named Alex Hurd, he's an editor at Outside Magazine, he wrote like a 4,000-word piece in the New Republic examining some of David Sedaris' stories, fact-checking David Sedaris' stories. And what he found was, in fact, David Sedaris not only embellished or exaggerated, he really made up a lot of what he was writing. He would take the smallest grain of truth. There's a story in his collection, Naked, called Dick's Hill, about his time volunteering at a psychiatric hospital when he was 13. In fact, Alex Hurd found out he did volunteer for a time at a psychiatric hospital when he was 13, but the extent of what he did was maybe like organizing some birthday parties for the residents. But in the story that he tells in the book, he's helping orderlies lift old ladies out of their bed, violent old ladies. You know, in the story, the lady leans forward and bites him on the arm. And, you know, he tells these versions of the stories that are very entertaining and just not true at all.
Yeah.
And Alex Hurd wrote this long investigative piece about it. He talked to David Sedaris for the piece. David Sedaris said, oh, I thought this day was going to come. And he seemed a little bit chastised. But then the piece was published and the reaction was, who is this idiot? Of course David Sedaris makes this stuff up. And the readers, what's interesting to me is that people know to take it with a grain of salt, and I think it's because he's a humorist for one thing, and I think it's also because he doesn't pretend to present it all as 100% accurate, and his readers don't really care. It's interesting because James Frey's readers were outraged. People filed
real
suit.
Betrayal.
I talked to his publishing company. His publicist said, you know, David calls his work realish. So, you know, he doesn't pretend that it's true. And I asked whether Little Brown, who publishes him, had thought about presenting his work differently, either as fiction or kind of acknowledging, yes, it's inflated, in the wake of all of these truth wars that have been happening. And his editor released a statement just saying, David Sedaris sees and describes the world as no one else does. Readers love him, we love him, and we'll continue to publish him in the same way we always have.
Short and sweet.
Yeah.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much for joining us. There's more online at www.nytimes.com/books. And for the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.